Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 68, right at the beginning, which is old single column, page 763. All right, we are starting a new block of papers. As it should be obvious from the title of this first one in the block, this is the block of papers on civilization. A lot about the evolution of civilization, but, it's not meant to just be a history lesson. The point is to acquire the truths of civilization, which are just as true today as they were way back, however far back it might be hearkening historically, and will be true, a million years into the future. It's, as I often say, like I was bringing out when we were going through all the history of the rebellion on this planet, it's very important especially when the material that you're engaging has an immediate tendency to get you just thinking in, I'm reading a history book mode, to not let yourself slip into that mode. You can get to that, but it's important to get the truths that they're trying to present first before you engage the historical facts. Because definitely, by the time you get to taking a more scientific eye, say, to the facts that are being presented, you are confronting the contrast between what humans currently believe in that knowledge area and the new wineskins that the revelators are trying to give you to approach those subjects. And you don't want to just be putting new wine in old wineskins. You prevent that happening. The wine is the facts. The wineskin is the sphere of truth within which those facts exist. Right? You need that that sphere of truth. You need that worldview, that frame, if you're going to have any success in burrowing down and making use of some of the details that are there to be mined by, basically a PhD specialist engagement in that particular field. It's always the case, we're not trying to do that in this setting, but that's completely appropriate. The whole point, whether or not you want to eventually do that or not, is to try to recognize the truths. And for those of you who have heard me engage issues in these civilization papers over the years, there is much of great importance here to why this book is in my lap in the first place. All right, we just read about how the civilizational uplifters dropped the ball. All right, the prince and his staff blew it. That's why these civilization papers follow the civilizational uplifter description of the prince and his staff. We still are in a very tenuous situation relative to that fact that we don't have those anchors of civilizational integrity that have been with us for 500,000 years, not only fostered the progress of civilization, but the mere maintenance of civilization, right, as anchors. So it's now reached ahead. We're spiritual enough now that we can genuinely go flying off on a tangent like we've never been able to do before. And so the fact that we don't have those anchors, that's the emergency. There's a civilizational emergency. It's very important to have the courage to face some of the very rugged truths that flow through these civilizational papers. They challenge, the conventional wisdom, quote unquote, very aggressively, because all that conventional wisdom is anything but wisdom. It's all false. I mean, everyone's worldview is false. And that's why the book is in my lap. We're about to implode. We're about to lose civilization. And you'll see that that's one of the very first things that they address right up front in these papers. So as is almost always the case, gird thy loins, as the Bible would say, and be ready to face that. You're going to have to rethink a lot of things, or if you already have begun to rethink, you have to be reminded all the more of how difficult it is once your eyes are open to not be in a awkward situation with those around you, whose eyes are still closed. And you don't want to go along to get along. You know the truth, and yet you don't want to just cloister yourself somewhere. You have to still be in the world, just not of the world. It can get very difficult at times. Because the more you have the truth, the starker the contrast gets. The more the double-edged sword is in play. Okay, so let's jump in. See what we have here.
Paper 68, The Dawn of Civilization. This is the beginning of the narrative of the long, long forward struggle of the human species from a status that was little better than an animal existence through the intervening ages and down to the later times when a real, though imperfect, civilization had evolved among the higher races of mankind.
Okay, it seems like a very matter-of-fact statement, but as usual, they made just those little statements a paragraph, and they want you to pause and perhaps notice a couple things. Little better than an animal existence, right? That's what we're always struggling with, being something besides just fancy animals. Doesn't matter how much we call what we're doing personal, it's not. Just fancy animal. If it was personal, you could look that word up in the dictionary. You can't. Very minimal personal even today. But you can tell that they're hinting that if nothing else, there's been some tendency to at least begin to socialize our human quality that we're given by grace, even if we haven't taken delight in cultivating and growing much beyond what we're given by grace, but at least to socialize and culturate what we have by grace so that there's something, you notice they're real, in a real, though imperfect, of course, civilization had evolved. And let me just put it right up front, even though you don't have the contrast there in that first paragraph, but it's very important to hold in mind the distinction between three technical terms: society, culture, civilization. They're not synonyms, especially not in the Revelation. You have an adjutant mind, hence genetic, natural foundation for that differentiation. That differentiation is predicated on the basic fact that there is society stems from the fifth adjutant. That rudimentary energy of that fifth adjutant that social urge. And so that fifth adjutant is a predicate for the very immediate beginning fact of just mere society. When you bring in the additional energy of the sixth adjutant, you get an upgrading of a mere society into a culture. And we basically have that sense. You know, you bring in some rudimentary, crude energy phenomenon of the religious impulse of the sixth adjutant. We talk about having cults. Culture. You're bringing in that a little bit of that additional energy, a little more, there's a little more unity consciousness in play, so that there's a little bit more energy that can lead to an upstep in the socialization. A basic society is an associative phenomenon. So you have the individuality on the one hand, of the individuals in the group. You have their relationship to unity on the other hand, and you have the super additive consequence of some measure of association. Right? And you're looking for higher and higher super additive consequences, greater and greater, more sophisticated associations. Bringing in more unity to relate to the individuality that's sort of all just there, in a large degree, at least biologically. But then when you go to the seventh adjutant and the relationship to your encirclement in the Holy Spirit, so you have the three cosmic intuitions, when you get that additional element and you begin to get a rudimentary personal phenomenon as a predicate, then you have civilization. Right? And that's when it begins to go from merely natural to something rudimentarily unnatural, something artful. Something artificial. Right? Civilization's a choice, not natural. You'll see they bring that out, those points out. But and we won't always point it out, but just, you notice, did they say society? Did they say culture? Did they say civilization? If you want to start, like I said, burrowing into the specifics of what they're getting at.
I have a question.
Yep.
As we go up the adjutants, we're going to be able to go from
five to six
societies to cultures to civilization. Yeah. So on the lower adjutants below that, can you say at this adjutant there's going to be tribes, at this adjutant there'll be...
No, you have to be careful about kind of taking sets and dreaming up ways to rationalize them together as somehow parallel sets. It's a pretty complicated situation. I mean, fundamentally, the point you're bringing out, we've talked about the adjutants before in the context of biologic evolution. Yeah. Right? So you have a rudimentary manifestation of the different energies of the adjutants just in terms of biologic evolution. We've got that foundation in place. Now we're thinking about social evolution on top of that. Now, obviously, in the very early stages, when you're, pre-Adam and Eve, so when biologic evolution is still working its way up to that plateau, like, we read about recently, the two are interplayed. But once biologic evolution is, has reached its plateau, and there's no way to go up except by biologic uplift, that's when you definitely begin to shift gears, and you're focusing on, how do the differentials amongst the adjutants play into the social evolution phenomenon? And that may be another good point to just bring up, as long as you've brought this contrast up. I've mentioned many a time that many humans have found a way to wrap their mind around, to find a place for the fact of biologic evolution. But there's still a lot of difficulty with allowing everything to be an evolutionary phenomenon. you know, like if you want to start contemplating the nature of spirit, to actually think about spirit in relevant ways for you as an evolutionary phenomenon instead of falsely as this existential thing that you're going to be relating to. You know, you're not an existential being. You're not going to be relating to anything existentially, fundamentally. You know, everything is an evolutionary phenomenon. Matter, mind, and spirit, and all of their association is an evolutionary phenomenon. So, I mean, just in many circles still today, if they get the sense that you are speaking very kind of coldly, matter-of-factly about social evolution, that's verboten stuff. You know, and you know why I say it in German, right? Right, it gets into very controversial territory, social Darwinism, quote-unquote, sorts of things, right? Even suggesting. There's a lot of belief that, you know, we're all born equal, you know, if not, we're all innately divine, you know, because of the rebellion. And like I said, if you try to go to spirit, the belief that spirit's innately divine, it's like, well, if spirit's innately divine, how did a spirit being like Lucifer go to iniquity? No, spirit's just an energy. To face the facts of evolution, and there's a lot of cold, hard facts, you know, when you talk about evolution, you know, beyond kind of the remote biologic issue. Oh, yeah, that's about those fossils and paleontology. This is about your day-to-day life we're talking about now, and to start suggesting that you're kind of just a cog in a big evolutionary machine in many ways, you know, and it just grinds on and doesn't really care for the individual that much, and biologic evolutionary process have any issues with the Permian extinction? No. Right? That facing facts and adjusting to ideals in order to achieve wisdom, see, it gets more difficult the more personal it becomes, right? Because as you go from biology to society, right, you're moving towards personal. And so it gets, you know, it gets a lot more controversial. Anyway, we'll be talking about lots of this, you know, as we go forward. Let's keep going here.
Civilization is a racial acquirement. It is not biologically inherent. Hence must all children be reared in an environment of culture, while each succeeding generation of youth must receive anew its education. The superior qualities of civilization, scientific, philosophic, and religious, are not transmitted from one generation to another by direct inheritance. These cultural achievements are preserved only by the enlightened conservation of social inheritance.
Okay, so look at just that second paragraph, and already a whole bunch of things in play. You can see them right there. See, speaking to the contrast between biologic evolution and social evolution, just in terms of, you know, it's not like with genetic inheritance. It's a little different, but nonetheless, things have to be passed forward. Okay, and we see the first thing there. See, civilization is a racial acquirement. It is not biologically inherent. So in other words, civilization is a choice, right? And fancy animals can't make choices. All they can make is decisions, right? And you have to bring in personality. You have to bring in free will. In order to genuinely get to civilization. You know, and again, free will is not self-assertion. It has nothing to do with mind manifesting outward in the material domain, as everyone has always thought. Right? That's not free will, that's self-assertion. Free will is using the potential for spirit influence on your mind. You know, having your mind do something unnatural. Right? That's free will. That's where you get civilization. Civilization is not natural. It's artificial. It's unnatural. It's an art form. It has an inescapable predicate of sophistication behind it, like they're saying there, scientific, philosophic, religious. And notice what they're, again, you know, how they, after they basically say that, you know, civilization is a choice, hence must all children be reared in an environment of culture. See, I will point it out there. So you notice they didn't say society. Right? You have to have the fullness of sort of the natural, if you will, and then on that foundation, you choose up from that civilization. Right? You can't take rudimentary mere society and then just, ta-da, I'm civilized, right? It's kind of, it has to, you have to bring it up, you know, any more than, you know, when you're thinking about the hourglass analogy of your mind, that you can just jump from laying on the level of fear on the bottom of the hourglass, you know, and jump right up to the sixth level of meaning and have a religious experience. Right? There's a whole bunch of levels in between. See, they very purposely said culture there. See, just notice that. And because it's such a choice, see, each succeeding generation of youth must receive anew. It doesn't automatically go forward. These cultural achievements there, and notice they're even using the contrast between preserve and conserve. Right? They say are preserved when, you know, you've got these things, these facts that have developed in the past, you know, the basic fact of science, philosophy, and religion, right? Those spheres are preserved. Now, what's within the spheres can't be static, right? It has to be living. But the fact that there's a scientific sphere, a philosophic sphere, and a religious sphere, right? Those the three spheres are preserved. But, you know, immediately they say, you know, it's not the past, the preserve, or merely the present with the observe, right? It's oriented to the future, conserve, right? Following the truths forward into the future, the facts evolving around that thread of truth, right, the eye of conservation, taking it forward. And again, only a person has any consciousness of future. Fancy animal doesn't. Fanciest of animals just know present and past. See, so again, you can see them. Right, the civilization involves personal being able to respond positively to a negative stimulus. Right? Your mind responding positively to a negative stimulus. That's what gives civilization that greater quality relative to mere culture. That fact. And what's the spark for that unnatural response? That's your religious nucleus. Right, about which you build that philosophic sphere. Once you've kind of got the basic physics of how this works, you can see how they're touching upon all these details, you know, just right in the very first statements they make. All right, what else do they say?
Social evolution of the cooperative order was initiated by the Dalmatia teachers, and for 300,000 years, mankind was nurtured in the idea of group activities. The blue man most of all profited by these early social teachings, the red man to some extent, and the black man least of all. In more recent times, the yellow race and the white race have presented the most advanced social development on Urantia.
One thing you can note there, they went ahead and just used that, you know, rough term of black man.
Yes. They don't do that.
Because, of course, you know, by the time, you know, you get to something happening in the wake of the rebellion and everything. I mean, you know, we know that, you know, there's already been all those issues with Green Man and Orange Man, and they've kind of been blended in, and you basically sort of just have, a secondary Sangic race now, a quote-unquote black man, you know, even if they aren't that black per se, you know, and might still be quite indigo in color or whatever, but that's why they did that. You know, you can see they did the white man, white race thing too, you know, just that vague sort of term. Obviously, you know, they're pointing out the differential between primary and secondary Sangics, you know, so one of the rudimentary things they're doing there. I remember how we kind of pointed that out, you know, that remember way back when we were talking about the civilizational uplifters, that their challenge is to try to get the fancy animals to do something genuinely human, personal. You know, it's especially when you have so many Andonites. We need that catalyst, that stimulus. You know,
the fifth adjutant doesn't do that on its own.
No, I mean it's just a social urge. You know, but you know, immediately you have this urge to pool together in a group, and immediately there's antagonisms amongst the individuals. And what do you get? Just a big pool of negative response to negative stimuli, and the group dissolves. Right? I mean, how does a group stay together? It's when people start being able to respond positively to a negative stimulus, because naturally a group is a negative stimulus, as they're about to talk about. It's difficult to find someone where, oh, wow, we don't even have to work at this. We're just on the same page all the time. And it's like, yeah, yeah. Try male and female. see how natural it is to just stay together.
It's two North Poles.
There's nothing trivial about this. You need to be able to, you know, that bit about cooperation, right, to bring in that personal influence on your mind. You know, tell your mind, no, you're going to respond positively to that negative stimulus. You know, and you can rationalize anything. You can treat anything as a negative stimulus. If you want to, you know, to take offense at something, you always can. Right? There's always something that's not perfect about it. You know, you have the most sublime joy that you're bathed in. But, you know, when you look at it really critically, it could be better joy. And, you know, and Bob is responsible for it not being better. And, you know, you can always take something as a negative situation. So, you know, it's difficult to cooperate. You know, and remember, that's, you know, we often use that word cooperative. You know, what the very first thing that the Universal Father did when he came into existence was to put himself into cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity, to the whole. And that's what everyone else has to do. You know, how are you going to actually hold a group together? Everyone has to reach up to the whole, transcendent of any of the parts, even if you're an infinite part, like the Universal Father. You know, if you, the moment you start thinking that you're the whole, you can forget about having a relationship to any other being in any real way. Yep.
That's also where true freedom lies.
Yes. Right. The freedom, you know, to have access to the whole and not be trapped in the island universe part.
That's right.
Right. Which might initially, you know, strike you as wonderful and you know, wanting to be there, but yeah, it grows old fast. Okay, let's see, anything else that we needed to mention there? Let's see, you know, we just read about, they're just reminding us of, you know, how we had 300,000 years where things were being nurtured, you know, for all these individuals to find some initial relationship to unity so that there would be an associative consequence, and, you know, there would be these more and more stable group phenomena happening. But then, you know, it all got blown up. Remember, we just read about it. Everything, you know, especially this sort of stuff, you know, basically got, it was worse than, in many ways, than 500,000 years ago when they started. And so this, the whole civilization thing on this planet, in many ways, is, you know, that which revelation fails to accomplish, evolution always achieves. Evolution, you know, has done a lot over 200,000 years to get something like, as they said there, when a real, though imperfect, civilization had evolved, at least among the higher races of mankind, like they said there. You know, when it's very limited to this slow, natural thing, you know, there's going to be a giant lagging tail to the whole phenomenon, as we all know, on our world. There's a lot of people that are in a very primitive state still in terms of civilization. You know, they haven't even really gone from clan to tribe yet, for instance, right? So, all right, let's keep going.
Section 1, protective socialization. When brought closely together, men often learn to like one another. But primitive man was not naturally overflowing with the spirit of brotherly feeling and the desire for social contact with his fellows. Rather, did the early races learn by sad experience that in union there is strength. And it is this lack of natural brotherly attraction that now stands in the way of immediate realization of the brotherhood of man on Urantia.
Okay, so that's a pretty sweeping statement by the time you get to the end of the paragraph. Okay, so let's think about that a bit. Because, you know, you might be all excited. It's like, ooh, okay, we just have to do some simple little thing, and ta-da, we'll be enlightened life. you know, you definitely have a lot of natural functioning of mind, you know, you can say sort of a vast conspiracy to get this thing going. It's just that the longer you're together and the more complicated it gets, the more tensions develop, okay? But there's a lot of naturalness to get it going. But as they reminded you there, you know, and with a thing called understatement, primitive man was not naturally overflowing with the spirit of brotherly feeling. You know, especially if you think very technically about, say, fourth level of meaning, brotherly love. Yeah, okay, and that's not going to be very natural, you know, to be beginning to get up out of the lower domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind and bringing in some insight from the Holy Spirit, some logical, you know, consciousness, for instance. But and like I mentioned, remember, it's all these things are ever more so with the Andonites, you know, who fundamentally aren't civilizable. Right, they're so primitive, you know, so they're needing to get blended into Sangiks, you know, to a large degree. Right, so it was a very difficult situation on this world to get it going. That whole bit of, you know, just the school of hard knocks, you know, 200,000 years and pound on us, you know, with a sledgehammer, you know, that whole time. And it actually sinks in eventually, some of these things, you know, to the point where, you know, you have that classic Aesop fable, you know, that they're alluding to there. In union there is strength, you know, and that, you know, especially when you get to the dawning of the fifth adjutant and the collective in the middle of the 19th century, you know, it's not surprising that there would have been a very intense delight with that old expression. That's why it's so commonly used. In union, there is strength.
Is that That's kind of the opposite of house divided.
You know, and remember that's the bundle of sticks analogy, right? You know, take very fragile sticks, but you bundle a bunch of them into a bundle, and you can't break that bundle. But you take it apart, you can easily break each of the sticks.
Right? Got to divide if you're going to conquer it.
Right, you have to divide if you're going to conquer it. Right. But they learned by sad experience. You know, lots and lots of individuals had to die before it finally got pounded in their head that, maybe I ought to try to find some way to get along with Bob, so that, we're not two little sticks that both can be easily broken. Yeah, particularly me. I really don't care that much about Bob, but if Bob will help me to not get broken, okay, I can put up with Bob. It gets started like that. It's still pretty selfish, right? Yeah. But you're willing to put up with someone just because, they'll shoot the guy that's coming at you, from behind, because they're facing the other direction. Yeah.
So hence the whole revelation, of Jesus, that, yes, Simon, all men are sons of God.
Yeah.
And therefore, it goes on to say that Jesus, that's why he stressed on them the whole aspect of brotherly love. Everybody's your brother. Here I can see that how that spiritual pressure from above, so to speak, is a way to make this natural thing into, as you mentioned, more artful, to where you can then begin to realize that, because it's not natural, right?
You need to have more potential of spirit over mind if you're going to get along in more complex groups for longer spans of time. There's going to need to be more spirit over mind, more and more and more.
That's why they make us live with all these different groups.
You know how long and methodical a process it is to get up through this constellation level, right? You can't just, it's like, well, I'm ascending Maranja being now. I can get along with anyone, not even remotely. No, we'll start you with just a couple people, and we won't give you knives. it's very difficult. Even when you have a Maranja mind and mode of consciousness and all that stuff, you have to slowly, okay, let's try one other person. Okay, now let's try two, let's try three. And the reason for that is remember, you leave the local system finally, definitively individuated. Your absolute unique personality is manifesting in a very giving you a very definitive individuality. So, now no longer do you have the grace of biologic commonality where you kind of just get along naturally, like say if you're all the yellow race, if you're all the sons of Han, and you're all kind of on the same mindal page. You don't have that grace anymore. Now, you're very definitively individuated as a person, and your personality doesn't overlap with any other personality in the universe of universes. And you've got to try to somehow find a way to get some relationship going with such a radically different personality. Yeah. I was obviously joking. You aren't literally going to be at each other's throats with knives, on the constellation worlds. But there is going to be, okay, I can't see any way that you can take oil and water and do anything with it here. You've got to find a way to transcend, get a super additive consequence, and go above that stark differential now that is now so clear.
Get a letter from our daughter, gets a roommate in college. No, I can't get along with my roommate at all. We got along well for the first month or so, and then it was just, can I move?
We say, oh, I wish I could be more personal. No, be careful what you ask for, right? Be thankful that you can hunt around and find someone with some reasonable genetic similarity so that there's just some grace of commonality. Yeah. And you don't have to start with zero synchronization, and try to somehow build some sort of relationship. You know, you can, maybe you both like, you know, vanilla ice cream, or you both like football or something, you know. You're just, it's just naturally there. You both like the color blue. Yeah, who knows? You know, something simple. You know, so at least you can agree what color to paint the house. You know, whatever.
Like harmony, you can't. Why do you think that is such a challenge and a struggle? I mean, because as a finite evolutionary being, when you finally achieve that status of being able to get along with pretty much anybody, you've achieved it by achieving it?
You've added something to the universe when you do that. When you actually get a super additive consequence of a real personal relationship, you've added something to the universe that the universal father can't create. Probably might be a little difficult to do. Right? If he could create that, you wouldn't exist. He would already have existed before time began. He's already done everything he can do. We're going up from him now. Right? The experiential is above the existential, not below it. I mean, the existential is fundamentally inherent in the concept of the I am, that initial philosophic in the beginning, in the conceptual beginning was the I am. And what isn't there is genuine experiential. And that's what we're adding. That's what's above the only existential being, the universal father. Everything experiential is above the universal father. He's not capable of even the tiniest iota of experiential manifestation. He's pure existential deity.
Don't they ask us to love one more person every day?
Right.
There's a whole lot of...
See if you can...
experience through you, in a way.
Right. I mean, he can, you know, there's a relationship that can't kind of completely understand, you know, of to all of what's being built upon his foundation, right? But, you know, when you're the first source and center of all things and beings, okay, I mean, picture that in the most obvious way. You're at the center of everything, and everything is on top of you. You're, you know, everything is built upon your foundation.
So that creates a supreme
being. Yeah, I mean, like the supreme being and, you know, everything else, yeah. I mean, all of it, you know, that's the whole point. Like she's saying, you know, to get... You know, to function in a genuine personal way so that you're a genuine individuality apart from the ocean, right? And so there can be a true relationship between two genuinely separated parts, you know, and you can get a genuine super additive consequence, something that wasn't there already. All the fancy animal additive consequences are already technically there. In the wholeness of the Supreme. Right? You're trying to add something. Yeah. So when you get into the details, see, you know, you have to not only transcend the universal father to add something real to the universe, you have to transcend the Supreme Being. Right? The Supreme Being is handling all the things that the drops of water in the ocean do, you know, the summation that is the Almighty leads to. You know, fundamentally you have to stand apart from that as well. Yeah. So you have to stand apart from both your father and your mother. Right? That's the whole point of having a child, is for them to be a super additive consequence of the two parents, to go above the two parents. That's the whole point of having a child. Right?
Not a clone.
Right? Not a clone of either one, or some just additive consequence of the two. Right? That's, yeah. Okay. Let's see here. Anything else we wanted to bring out there? Let's see. The end part. Yeah, the flourish at the end. So it is this lack of natural brotherly attraction that now stands in the way of immediate realization of the brotherhood of man on Urantia. Oh, well, let's just get more natural brotherly attraction.
What?
Do you see any biologic uplifters anywhere?
Yeah.
No. Right. I mean, we talked about this a lot. We're the world where an awful lot of it has to be done unnaturally. On a run-of-the-mill world, a lot of it is natural. This world, you know, especially with the rebellion and the fall. But it was started with this idea in mind, being an experimental world, right? This is supposed to be a world where more than normal, it's unnatural, the brotherhood of man. Right? Being a two-brainer, the brotherhood of man is less natural than three-brainers, etc. Right? You know, all it did is sort of just shined a spotlight on the fundamental truth of this world to have a rebellion and a default here. Nothing really fundamentally changed by those factual events. It's still, the truth still stands. You're supposed to do things quite unnaturally. To be manifesting a personal nature a lot sooner than many, you might say. To take a hold of your bootstraps, yeah, and just choose civilization, despite how unnatural it is on this world, because of both nature and nurture. Okay, so you know, it's just you don't, unless you're thinking precisely. You know, it's like, oh, all I have to do is just find this natural state that leads to the brotherhood of man. See, that's not what that sentence is saying. All right. But it could.
Sounds good.
But if you put the new wine in the old wineskin, that's what that sentence will say. You won't get truth flowing through that paragraph. You'll get error flowing through that paragraph. Right? As we say all the time, right? Nothing forces any truth to be acquired from this book. And if you put all the sentences in the old wineskins, you'll get nothing but error. The old errors, and more even exotic errors than anyone has ever had. That's all you'll end up with.
Fancier
errors. you know, you think a little bit of knowledge of genetics led to some problematic errors with the Nazis. Try this thing out for size. What it could lead to in ignorant minds.
Which they speak to, I think. Even though we're risking something.
Okay, let's keep going.
Association early became the price of survival. The lone man was helpless unless he bore a tribal mark which testified that he belonged to a group which would certainly avenge any assault made upon him. Even in the days of Cain, it was fatal to go abroad alone without some mark of group association. Civilization has become man's insurance against violent death, while the premiums are paid by submission to society's numerous law demands.
Yeah, like, I'm my own man, you're not going to put any mark on me. Well, it's been nice knowing you. And your life expectancy is about 5 minutes. So you know, all, you quickly weeded those out of the gene pool, all those people. How that sort of anti-social genetics got, you know, taken out of the gene pool in short order. Now, of course, you know, it comes around. Right, there's still recessive genetics. You get a you know, a fundamentally more pleasant environment. Right, and what happens? Right, you get the salubrious climb again, and what happens? Right, more and more. Right, you get you know, this sort of antisocial genetics, you know, coming out again, and the problems you know, start building up again. You know, so the social evolution has that same issue, just like biologic evolution. You know, you get just enough medical knowledge to keep people with genetic issues from dying, but not enough to cure them. Yeah. And so then the, you know, that just, you know, more and more people have diabetes, say, right, with each generation until, you know, it's just this gigantic problem, you know, of a gene cesspool. Yeah, so you have this parallel thing, see, that happens. All right, see, what else we have there? You know, we all remember the whole bit about, you know, it was with Cain and that whole tribal mark thing. It was the fear of all that, you know, that finally got him to challenge himself more deeply, and he finally got an adjuster. Remember, he went to his mom, and you know, they'll mention that too. That whole issue of the response to fear is a powerful initiator. Right? How did the prince's staff get religion going? The fear of the Lord. You know, they didn't start with the God of love. That doesn't work. That's fourth epical revelation. They're the first epical revelation. Right?
Of course, that still comes up even downstairs.
Yeah. Right. Well, and again, that, you know, there is an awful lot of people on the planet that haven't gotten really initiated with the fear of the Lord yet. Right? And so actually it's rebellious to try to skip over their evolutionary steps and just give them like fourth epical stuff, let alone fifth epical stuff. Yeah. Yeah, when they haven't even done first, second, right? You know, we have to remember that. Remember they talked about that. That's the whole Lucifer rebellion. Now let's skip all the developmental steps. Let's just go straight to light and life. You know, that doesn't get you what you're hoping for. So you know, and that's the, you know, the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it, right? He recognized where someone was. You know, if they were at a very rudimentary, primitive level, he worked there. Because to do otherwise would be, at best, self-righteous of him, right? Not respectful of the evolutionary process, and you know that when that person's place in the big picture, you know, he didn't grab them and try to wrench them out of their place in the system. If they were ready for something grandiose, okay, you know, he'd give them the discourse on reality or the discourse on time and space, right? But, you know, if they were in a very rudimentary thing, you'd just give them some very rudimentary issues.
Here's mud in your eye.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like John was just saying, yeah. Okay, so, you know, just remember that. You know, if you like to engage those in the world, do you actually try to live by, of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it? Or is that just a platitude that you spout? But the way you minister is in complete defiance of that, the truth of that statement. You do a one-size-fits-all. You know, there's not a lot of people on the planet that are ready for the fifth epical revelation, right? For a non-dispensational revelation.
And most people don't have any consciousness of... thinking, there's these different levels of understanding.
And you know what leads to that, right? I mean, is that your individuality consciousness that takes you? No, that's your unity consciousness. You know, your unity consciousness says, no, everyone is equal. Yeah, spiritually. But because, you know, that's only minimally important, you know, when we're so primitive still, right? We're not even remotely the same materially or mindily. Yeah, and that's the most important thing. You know, to start with, to face that fact, adjust it to those spiritual ideals, right? And achieve a wisdom of relationship to people, to treat them as elements with differences within a complex, harmonious system, right? You know, not every cell in your body is a skin cell. And that's kind of handy, if you think about it a little bit. How long would you live if you didn't have heart cells? Instead, they were replaced by skin cells.
Oops. Oh, right.
Okay. Let's see here. What else do we have there? Yeah, I mean, I was already, you know, pointing that out, that whole bit of, you know, say, actually use the association, see, and again, individuality, unity, associativity, it's just the price of survival. Now, We don't have to bring it up every time, but it might be handy for you as we go through these civilization papers to just have a bookmark back there. You know, and what paper is that? Paper 50, section 5. Those developmental epics.
Yeah.
Right? The developmental epics of progressive civilization. Because, of course, we are very much constantly indirectly referring to those. Right? And when you're talking about the rudimentary things, you know, we bring them up all the time. You can easily remember them. All right, you start out, you know, if you've gotten there, that's page 576 in the single column, old single column. All right, you have the nutrition epic, the security age, and the material comfort era. Those are the three you start with. So an awful lot of what you're initially reading about is the interplay in those, with those initial three. Trying to move, you know, from the nutrition epic into the security age, when they say the price of survival, okay, they're not talking about food there. They're talking about being skewered with a spear, right? Right, so you're getting into the next one, the security age, right? And hopefully, eventually, you get to enough comfort level where you can get to the material comfort era, and there might be time for, just going on a vacation, just because, say, right? Something like that. Right? It was a long time before any human had such luxury. All right, so just, I'll often refer to that if you can't remember. The one, to at least have in mind of what mankind is currently potentially quivering on the very brink of moving into is that next one, the quest for knowledge and wisdom. Right? And you think about the superior qualities of civilization, scientific, philosophic, and religious. See? So, when they said real though imperfect civilization, I hadn't really thought about that. To really kind of have the word civilization be a little bit more in fact instead of just in truth, I need to get to the quest for knowledge and wisdom. To really begin to get something that's a little more appropriately labeled civilization. You need to get beyond where we are right now. And then the last little thing they bring in there. So the premiums for that, this insurance, the premiums are paid by submission to society's numerous law demands. And it's interesting that they went ahead and just stated that in sort of that full territorial state mode of saying laws, not just folkways, mores, whatnot, but going all the way to law, so that you can immediately appreciate, what's going on right now. How we are going rapidly into false liberty. It's not liberty in law anymore, right? One of the sure signs of a civilizational emergency when you have more and more people, saying you're not the boss of me, I'm not going to follow your laws. Or even sadder, when you start to see people that don't even have the ability to think abstractly enough anymore to even appreciate what a law is, right? The concept, the difference between a nation of laws and a nation of men, right? You see a lot of people in this country that really, law is just too abstract a thing. They can understand some strong man telling them something just arbitrarily, in king-like fashion. They get that, right? And they'll howl and scream if someone doesn't behave that way. If they say, no, we have laws, and we need to, no, I hate laws, Just throw out an edict, right? That tension is growing very rapidly right now, right? We're losing And we're losing our relationship, to those higher levels of order in our society, right? Because it takes some sort of personal nature. Fancy animals can't relate to laws. Fancy animals can do edicts and stuff, right? It takes some sort of philosophic person to think abstractly enough to relate to laws, to put themselves in submission to an abstraction. You'll put yourself in submission to a strong man, right? Because he's got thugs with guns. But are you going to put yourself in submission to this abstraction of a law? You can't even touch it. Right? A lot of people, right? And remember, it's problematic with without the limited biologic uplift. I mean, regardless of a decay of civilization, we don't have a lot of genetically sound people on the planet that can even relate to laws yet. I mean, they're just, that's why they're still in clans and tribes. They haven't even gotten to nations, let alone that next step to laws, to territorial states. They can't wrap their minds around an abstraction like a law. And they're certainly not going to submit to it. Right? The Arabs would submit to Muhammad the strong man. We have to appreciate these things, and not get ahead of ourselves in what we think is possible in this world yet. Okay, so
think it'll all work out?
It'll definitely all work out. One day this world will be settled in light and life.
We have a rough road.
Right. But don't look for it in your lifetime. And it could be a very rough road, but rougher. Super rough or not quite so rough, whatever. In the long run, it all comes out. Everything will be fine in the end. There's nothing to fundamentally fear, but there may be things to be courageous relative to. That unnatural thing called courage. Right. It's natural to be loyal. It's unnatural to be courageous. The energy of loyalty, the third adjutant, is natural. The spirit of courage, the third adjutant, is unnatural. And the spirit of anything in a material creature like me is unnatural. I'm not naturally a spirit being. Right? So any of those, those names are the adjutants. Those are the personal names, the unnatural names. Those aren't the natural names. That's the energy of instinct, the energy of rationalization, the energy of loyalty, etc. Those are the natural things. A civilized people, have citizens who are this spirit of courage, and spirit of knowledge, etc. They do unnatural things. Okay, let's keep going here.
Primitive society was thus founded on the reciprocity of necessity and on the enhanced safety of association. And human society has evolved in age-long cycles as a result of this isolation fear and by means of reluctant cooperation.
Okay. So I was like, I guess it's a start. But, they're just reminding you of how tenuous, you have for a starting point. It's pretty kind of harsh. The reciprocity of necessity. I need you, and you need us, right? I mean, it's that simple reciprocity, and that gets it going.
So you're grudgingly going into
all right. All right, I hate cooperating, but I guess I'll do it because I hate dying even more.
Lesser of two.
All right, so that's how it gets started in that very tenuous way. That's what gets clans and tribes going, right? Those rudimentary associations. But to go to nation, it's got to be more than such primitive sorts of things. And the less there is, you know, the more we're just, you know, naturally going back to tribes, you know, in this country. Okay, what else do they say here?
Primitive human beings early learned that groups are vastly greater and stronger than the mere sum of their individual units. 100 men united and working in unison can move a great stone. A score of well-trained guardians of the peace can restrain an angry mob. And so society was born, not of mere association of members, but rather as a result of the organization of intelligent cooperators. But cooperation is not a natural trait of man. He learns to cooperate first through fear, and then later because he discovers it is most beneficial in meeting the difficulties of time and guarding against the supposed perils of eternity.
Okay, again, they're stressing that natural, unnatural contrast. And right there it is, supersummative, see? Right, that you don't just have a mere additive thing happening. And even if they didn't think about it technically like that, oh, look at our supersummative nature here. You know, they experientially got the essence of that, right? And so that's really handy. I don't need 100 cops to handle 100 people. Huh, that's cool. And we can do that just with our rudimentary personal nature, human nature that we're given by grace. That initial encirclement of the Holy Spirit gives you enough of that super additive potential, right, to get it going like that. For us to kind of, oh, I get it. That's handy. And we could probably do that in other ways. And that sort of false multiplier sort of an idea, we recognize. And see, again, they're stressing this whole bit about how you have a system, an organization, an organism. Right? It has skin cells and heart cells and brain cells and right, different types of individual units within it. And again, using that word cooperation, you can see very much in a personal sort of a mode.
It's like team sports in a way.
Yep, right. Of course
the
it
individuals
is.
Individuals may not be that great, but together they...
Yeah, and as they pointed out, it was men that led the way in these discoveries, with war, getting these, discovering modes of efficiency and whatnot. So just the way that we developed as a society, men tended to make a lot of these discoveries first. They get into that later in these papers. And it's just out of, like I said, a school of hard knocks, after many armies have died trying to be just a bunch of rugged individualists, Well, I'm super burly, we're all going to be fine. And so, and the bunch of less burly guys kill you. And it's like, well, how did that happen? Right? What did they have that we didn't have?
Helicopter.
They were working together, as an association.
It wasn't a brawn issue.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It was that organization thing. Yep.
So when we witness an unruly mob... not being controlled, something's interfering with their organization.
Yeah, there's a decay of organization, yeah.
And perhaps being superimposed upon on ones who are supposed to...
Either we've forgotten how to control a mob, or maybe it's even more insidious. Someone doesn't want the mob controlled anymore, right? Et cetera. All these antisocial civilization destroying things starting to manifest. Yeah. It's like, well, I want to pretend that there aren't mobs that need to be controlled. Okay.
What's that noise outside?
Something about being awakened from a dream world of your imagination. Go read in Rodin, see if you can find that sentence. All right. Okay. So, and then at the end there, that paragraph there, see, again, first through fear. I mean, that's a very important. You know, if fear didn't prime the pump for humans, the moment you went from animal to human, you know, with Anna and Fonta, say, fear would disappear. Right? But no, it's still there because it still has value to get things going. But then, you know, and they'll talk about this quite a bit as we get further into the paper, this whole bit of bringing in this whole imaginary spirit world and all of its sublime fears, right? I mean, that starts to become a very important motivator, too. Okay, keep going.
The peoples who thus early organized themselves into a primitive society became more successful in their attacks on nature as well as in defense against their fellows. They possessed greater survival possibilities. Hence has civilization steadily progressed on Urantia, notwithstanding its many setbacks. And it is only because of the enhancement of survival value in association that man's many blunders have thus far failed to stop or destroy human civilization.
See, have you ever thought about that? You know, like why we still exist, see, is because of that super summative thing is just innately there. And if it was just additive, you know, summative, just summative. And see, they're pointing out now you would have died out a long time ago. Right? We live on the grace of super additivity.
Synergistic gains.
Right, that there's more to destroy than the sum of the parts. Right? There's a wholeness that is difficult for just lots of nagging individualities to fundamentally destroy. Right? So, that they're just trying to stress that that's a way that you can recognize that this isn't just an intellectual exercise. No, this is a literal fact that there's more than the sum of the parts there. Right? It has a substance to it, if you will. Right? It doesn't, you know, it isn't just an illusion that offers no resistance. No, it stands unmoved under a lot of assault. It's a something. Okay? You can handle a lot of nagging little, you know, ankle-biting phenomena, right, if you have a solid integrity. But, you know, the whole divide and conquer, right? If you can turn it into, if you can break that super additive consequence, so that it's just a collection of parts, and then it's much easier to pick it off. Because, you know, it's just one at a time then. Right? It's just a simple little thing of attrition. You just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. You know? Yeah.
Pick up stick.
But if the only way to get to an individual is through the individuality of its wholeness, see, it's much more difficult. You know, and maybe just one little comment, right? I mean, we talked about how we're descending back into tribes. You know, what can make us a nation, one nation under God? Right? If each individual is reaching up to God, right, and that's the nucleus about which we form a nation, transcendent of tribal phenomena, there are those that recognize that that's the source of the integrity of it as a system, an organization. So if you can get everyone to let go of God, right, which they've been actively working on for a long time now, right, then you can just pick them off one at a time. That's how you destroy this nation. Right?
Get rid of the bonding agent.
Right. Get rid of the nucleus. Right? And you're very naive if you think that that's just a coincidence that it's working out. No, there are those that long ago, you know, understand this. Understanding this physics set about that task. You have to destroy the integrity as an organism, so that it's just a bunch of parts that you can pick off one at a time, easily.
And those long ago were?
Just, you know, those insidious individuals that wanted to remake the country, and knew the only way was to disrupt these things like religion that bind us together. You know, so you just begin to eat at that. And now you have organizations that are dedicated to freedom from religion. Right? Things like that. Everyone knows that there's a Bible about this, Rules for Radicals.
Yeah.
Right? There's a reason that Saul Alinsky dedicated that to Lucifer. Right, the first person who tried to divide and conquer like that. All right, so again, see, it doesn't take long when you talk about civilization to immediately be hearkening back to, right, you know, what was going on with the Lucifer Rebellion, right, and how, unfortunately, the very things that he was attempting to do are being done today.
So, a lot of people today are looking at a lot of the religions that they see about them. Whether religion is defined properly or not is another question, but, looking at them and thinking, oh, this is a lot of dogma, and throwing the baby out with that bathwater.
Yeah.
And, what else do they have to reach out to? You know, the rules for radicals... when you've thrown that baby out, is a logical step.
Yeah, you're going to use your religious impulse on something. Right.
I'm a rebel.
And if it's not religion, things are going to get very problematic. I mean, the most primitive religion, because of this super additive thing, is orders of magnitude better than no religion. Right. If you're unwittingly, and don't understand that physics, it's like, well, let's just have a bunch of spiritual individuals. Well, then there's no super additive consequence, no super summative phenomenon. And if everyone is spiritual but not religious. And it's innocent enough, like you said. I mean, a lot of times, like, I just don't want to be dogmatic. I don't want to adopt all those goofy old primitive doctrines. Yeah, but you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And you don't recognize that. If you think that the greatest problem is on this planet is primitive religion, and that the solution is to get rid of religion, you are you've unwittingly been sucked into the sophistries of the Lucifer Rebellion.
That's cosmic anarchy.
Yeah. Primitive religion is a fake boogeyman, in terms of real harm befalling us. Sure, primitive religion, if they get very militant, can give us a lot of actual harm, blowing things up and killing us and whatnot. But that doesn't affect my soul. And that doesn't, fundamentally eat at civilization. The so-called boogeyman of primitive religion is, that's not a real boogeyman. The real boogeyman is the voice that says, no, we should have no religion, and we should all just be spiritual.
Imagine that,
one might say.
The whole sentence, and it is only because of the enhancement of survival value and association that man's many blunders have thus far... Mm-hmm. Stop.
Yeah, see, just the way they said that, thus far failed.
Yeah, thus far.
Yeah, like, right, I mean, why is the book in my lap, right? It's not because, you don't have to worry about that anymore. No, that's, if we didn't have to worry about that anymore, this book wouldn't be in my lap. Things would have just gone on until the next dispensational revelation and all that, why did they step in, right? It's because things could, unravel it. Yeah.
Well, Well, what you said a minute ago, you know, a lot of people who read the Urantia book are advocates, spiritual, but not religious, so to speak. In other words, because of the, somebody mentioned, because of the...
Yeah, like Katie mentioned, the doctrine, and all the goofy doctrinal things, yeah.
Right. So, I mean,
but just,
even with the book in your lap that these people, I don't think that that has really struck home a lot in terms of, you know, having done this for years and years and years, is this big thing about, oh, let's not have a religion. Let's not, you know, turn this into a religion, have a religion around it to a certain degree. And, you know, even amongst people that are like us, who could do that in our own little hometowns and so socializing, etc. And what you say is kind of interesting, that that trend is...
Right.
Is it more places?
Because it's the conventional wisdom thing. It's just a new wine in old wineskins. You know, there's just so many things we're caught up in, and we just haven't stepped back. And it's like, wait a minute. Now that's a problematic thought. There's a baby in a bathwater there. To overuse that, you know, much used expression, but you know, it's just a handy expression. You know, that you have to at some point snap out of just the way you've been taught to think about things. Yes, there are a lot of, you know, unfortunate doctrinal beliefs in the current religions. But don't remember, those are evolutionary phenomena. Don't forget. Those are. Don't forget that those are evolutionary phenomena, and there's value in the products of evolution. You know, we have a tendency to get all focused on the existential, and what you end up doing is existential good, evolutionary bad. You know, you don't recognize you slip into that mode. Evolution is good. It's just, you know, it's a temporal goodness instead of an eternal goodness. It's perfectingness instead of perfectness, but they're both goodness. Right? And so, you know, we have to remember that we can't just throw out all of these, the last 200,000 years of evolutionary production. There's lots of value in all those evolutionary constructs, even if they're, you know, from some high vantage point, they're quote unquote primitive. It may be a primitive religion, like I'm saying, but at least it's religious, right? And that's important. It's not merely spiritual. That's important. It's very easy to lose all sight of genuinely worshiping God and just ending up reverencing unity. You know, and you got to be careful you don't fool yourself, because there's few people that haven't heard some notion of God. And in the lower domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind, you can have that some notion of God that you were taught, and you can juxtapose that with your reverencing of unity, and it will appear to you that you're worshiping God. But you're not. You're just reverencing unity. Because on the second level of meaning, actual knowing of God, not just knowing about some notion of God, but actually knowing God, is way up on the sixth level of meaning, genuine religious consciousness. So, you can't satisfy yourself with the reverencing of unity, the feelings of reverencing unity on the second level of meaning, the level of the feelings, combined with just, you know, whatever your favorite notion of God is that you've been exposed to. You know, maybe you've taken the Urantia book and developed some notion of God. From the words that are in the book. I mean, again, the words in the book have nothing to do with actually knowing God. To actually get up there and have a genuine personal spiritual experience on the sixth level of meaning, not just a spiritual experience on the second level of meaning, but a personal spiritual experience on the sixth level of meaning, and there's a huge difference there. And it's only with that starting point that there's genuine worshiping of God rather than reverencing of unity masquerading as worshiping God. You know, and again, I'm not dreaming this up. You know, all that stuff is just directly stated in the book. Right? You know, it's, again, like I said, I mean, it's a sobering thing to recognize is that the foundation of that actual knowing of God is a thing called faith. You know, up there in the sixth level of meaning. But that's the foundation of that fact up there. And how sad is it that you can't look up the word faith in the dictionary? Right? When you look it up in the dictionary, it says, as the revelators say, it's a simple childlike belief. That's the definition in the dictionary. Simple childlike belief. That's not genuine faith. That, in an earnest little child, that might be the shadow cast down, you know, in the lower domain as a belief from a superconscious fact of faith. That's not conscious faith, that simple childlike belief. Right? That's just a simple childlike belief. Right? That's the definition in the dictionary. Right? It doesn't have the actual genuine word faith defined in the dictionary. And it can't, because no human knows the difference between personalized self and self. I mean, they don't know the difference between free will and self-assertion. So obviously they don't know the difference between personality and self. We haven't consciously gotten up there. We're super consciously up there by grace. But, you know, the dictionary tells you the facts. What we think the word personality refers to, what we think the word free, you know, the expression free will refers to, it's like, no, that's not free will, that's self-assertion. If we already knew all that stuff, it wouldn't even talk about it in the Revelation. See, again, you know, that's why I talk so much about that stuff in the Revelation, because it's a revelation. The word faith, genuine faith, is a revelation to us. They're not affirming that you already know what this faith thing. They're revealing faith to you. The fact of faith. But, you know, no one has to get worried, right? Because by grace, you have those things superconsciously. By grace, you even have a thought adjuster and a soul. And hence, you're saved. So you don't even have to, you can take your salvation for granted. So the big fear is off the table. Right? So now, see if you can work on taking what you already have superconsciously by grace, seeing if you can be grown up so that your eyes are at that level and you can see it consciously. Faith is in front of your eyes instead of way up there, that you have to go reach way up and do that blind faith grasp thing way up there. Above what you can see? What would it be like if it wasn't that blind faith grasp anymore? What if it was right in front of you and you could see it? Well, it wouldn't be faith anymore. Then that faith would have been matured into trust. Right? And you would be not merely a child of God anymore. You would be a budding adult of God. All right. What else do we have here? Let's keep chugging along here.
That contemporary cultural society is a rather recent phenomenon is well shown by the present-day survival of such primitive social conditions as characterize the Australian natives and the Bushmen and Pygmies of Africa. Among these backward peoples may be observed something of the early group hostility, personal suspicion, and other highly antisocial traits which were so characteristic of all primitive races. These miserable remnants of the non-social peoples of ancient times bear eloquent testimony to the fact that the natural individualistic tendency of man cannot successfully compete with the more potent and powerful organizations and associations of social progression. These backward and suspicious antisocial races that speak a different dialect every 40 or 50 miles, illustrate what a world you might now be living in, but for the combined teaching of the corporeal staff of the planetary prince and the later labors of the Adamic group of racial uplifters.
Is it not obvious what's between the lines at the end there? That you might be living in again if you don't do what we said at the beginning of the paper, consciously see to the passing forward of the foundations of civilization. Because you'll just drop back into the natural thing. Right? Are our two political parties getting more or less suspicious of each other? Are they more tribal? Yes. Right. Less and less are we a nation. You don't even bother with suspicion anymore. It's just an a priori assumption. Of black and white. Those of us on this side of the line are innately divine, and those on the other side of the line are innately evil, right? And everything they do is evil and wrong and must be resisted, and, yeah. It's just, it's a bunch of Bushmen again.
Now, the other thing is, their description of Bushmen, I'll guarantee you, isn't what most of us think of when we think of Bushmen. If anything,
oh yes, right. They're just about to mention that in the next paragraph, right? Our exaltation of the natural, yes, the false exaltation. Taking the Aboriginal peoples and lifting them up to the pinnacle of what we should be striving for, and so we all earnestly strive, supposedly up to that. But what direction are we actually going? Down, right? We have no vertical sense of direction anymore, right? We think we're going up and we're actually going down. And of course, just all of that, just me saying that, let alone what they say specifically in here, wow, how politically incorrect was that paragraph? Miserable remnants? Okay, yeah. You'd be crucified if you said that in public.
Heresy.
Right? I won't say it every time, but sometimes just imagine one of our political leaders stepping forward to a microphone on a national broadcast and reading one of these paragraphs. You think you can think of a controversial thing that some political leader has said? No, you've never heard a controversial thing. Imagine them reading a paragraph out of the Arantia book, some of these paragraphs, right? Right. We wouldn't just be howling at them. We would literally execute them on the spot. Right? There would be a mob that would just, descend upon them.
It would be so out of context, though.
Right.
Context is really, really important.
Yeah. And the more controversial the sentences get in the Arantia book, the more important it is for you to have the context of the whole book. Right? For you to have some synthetic acquirement from the revelation instead of just an analytic acquirement. I've memorized that sentence or that paragraph, or I remember that section. Right, those are facts divorced of truth. You need them in their context of truth. Yeah, and of course that's what, we all know the revelation is an awful lot about that. Getting us to face some very difficult facts, but trying to get us to have the integrity of the truth to be able to face those facts and not see them in such poor light. I mean, when you say miserable remnant, you're not questioning how much God the Father loves that individual. And why aren't you? What did Jesus say? He's your spiritual father, right? Not your material or mindal father. all right, like I said, get this last paragraph here.
The modern phrase, back to nature, is a delusion of ignorance, a belief in the reality of the one-time fictitious Golden Age. The only basis for the legend of the Golden Age is the historic fact of Dalmatia and Eden. But these improved societies were far from the realization of utopian dreams.
Ah, yes. Not mincing any words. A delusion of ignorance. No, no, no. That's the wisest thing that society has to offer. Oh, dear me. See?
This one you thought they were done being.
No. See, because that, yeah, it is back to nature, back down. Right? To animals are natural. Humans are unnatural. Right? That's the whole point.
Did you give him start that? Like
and it's,
nature, sorry.
And again, it's not that, okay, it's not that, we're not saying that nature's evil. See, don't think of it in dichotomy. Right? It's just that nature is a good beginning, not a good ending. It's only good as a beginning. In the context of being a beginning, is it good? The moment you flip it around and make it an ending, it becomes bad. All good things taken to extreme become bad, right? Like taking a beginning and taking it to an ending, right? It's going to become bad, right? Natural is how we start. But you're heading into a cosmic system that's mind-made and personality-managed in toto. Right? When the grand universe is settled in light and life, there's not one single automaton left that's natural. Every single automaton, every atom, is in an unnatural state.
Even dirt?
Even dirt. Right? There's
dirt
nothing.
May exist.
Dirt will exist. There's nothing natural about the dirt on a Havona world. Right? Right? Remember, they tell you that the dirt from world to world is absolutely different, reflecting the absolute difference of the eternal of days, you know, from world to world. Right? It's purely artificial, everything. That's what things are evolving to. Right? So how false is this back to nature idea? Right? But don't treat that as a dichotomy. Right? Again, it's not. Nature's not bad. It's just, it's not the ending. It's not the goal.
I don't know. My organic food tastes better sometimes than my chemical.
Yeah. But just think about how delicious, the food that the material son and daughter make on Gerasim is.
Well, I haven't tried it.
All right. And it doesn't just naturally grow on trees that way, right? I mean, because again, there aren't any naturally growing trees. I mean, everything is just,
we don't have any replicates.
All right, so.
Part of that is when we say back to nature, a lot of people think, oh yeah, I know about these people who make food taste horrible by doing this chemical thing with it or that chemical thing with it or putting this kind of pesticide on it or whatever. Yeah, there are people who are really, really bad at doing artistic kind of things. Mm-hmm. Just because some technicians or would-be so-called artist kind of people do things poorly doesn't mean that it can't be. And, there is a trend for a whole lot of poor farmers, people who are doing farming or other kinds of things that aren't doing it well and aren't doing it in a safe, healthy way. Yeah, and that's why your organic food is often tasting better. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't throw out trying to figure out a better way to do things.
Right. Again, the very fact that most artificial stuff that we have is of poor quality, that's because it's sad to record. That's just a reminder that there's very little personal, actual human consciousness on the planet. Fancy animals don't do artificial well. Humans do. Right? Again, there is ugly art. Therefore, there is no beautiful art. Huh? Right? There's ignorant notions of God, therefore there is no God. Falsehood exists, therefore truth doesn't exist. Huh? Right, that's skepticism, right? That last one, right? That's the fundamental tenet of skepticism. falsehood exists, therefore truth does not exist. Is that logical? No. Right, and there's just all these variations on that theme. Right, I mean, the artificial, do you think that the artificial on the Isle of Paradise and everything there is poor quality? No. I mean, everyone knows the Isle of Paradise didn't just naturally spring into existence out of the Big Bang or something, right? It's purely artificial. It's a construct of art. Artistic hands. Yeah. All right. Well, we probably can't get through this whole section, but maybe we ought to dive into it a little bit here.
Section 2, factors in social progression. Civilized society is the result of man's early efforts to overcome his dislike of isolation. But this does not necessarily signify mutual affection. And the present turbulent state of certain primitive groups well illustrates what the early tribes came up through. But though the individuals of a civilization may collide with each other and struggle against one another, and though civilization itself may appear to be an inconsistent mass of striving and struggling, it does evidence earnest striving, not the deadly monotony of stagnation.
Yeah, we kind of already spoke to that bit of... it does evidence earnest striving. Fundamentally, why? Because civilization is not natural. If there's civilization, someone has chosen something, done something unnatural. Again, that's another way to kind of think, a mere decision is natural. A choice is unnatural. Because you're in time. Time is natural. Choice is tied to eternity. That's unnatural. It's unnatural for eternity to be tied to time. Now, there's a really profound relationship of eternity to time. It's called a mystery of mysteries because it's so unnatural. Okay. And again, when they stress like isolation there, in italics and things, again, remember, we're all made by God. Beginning on the first level of meaning, it's just in a simple sense is a level of selfishness. One of your first words was mine. That's not because you're the child of the devil, right? You're by nature sinful and unclean or something like that. No, that's good as a beginning. Because again, you have to start out with a bit of individual integrity just given to you by grace. Because you're trying to get up to being absolutely individuated with your personality. If you started as just part of, diffused into an ocean, that you would just magically individuate out of the ocean and then personalize? No, you have to be pulled out of the ocean by a creator being and individuated as a starting point. Yeah, but it has. If you take it too far, it becomes problematic. It leads to isolation, like they're saying. Let's see what else we have there. I think we've talked about some of these basic things so much. But you can just see how they're just stressing. That in very short order. You have this mass of striving and struggling, as we're all so familiar with, agendas, at odds with one another and whatnot. And, so it takes greater and greater transcendence, to somehow harmonize more and more aggressive individuality.
Mm-hmm. While the level of intelligence has contributed considerably to the rate of cultural progress, society is essentially designed to lessen the risk element in the individual's mode of living, and it has progressed just as fast as it has succeeded in lessening pain and increasing the pleasure element in life. Thus does the whole social body push on slowly toward the goal of destiny, extinction or survival, depending on whether that goal is self-maintenance or self-gratification. Self-maintenance originates society, while excessive self-gratification destroys civilization.
Okay. For those who are familiar with these papers, we'll talk a lot about these issues like self-maintenance and self-gratification. And notice that they take it all the way to your relationship to eternity, out of time to eternity, where it becomes binary. And then, like we talk about all the time, there's only two things, only two possible relationships to eternity, all or nothing. Right? You know, it's either extinction or survival. Right? It's either, survival or oblivion. And it starts out with these subtle little things of self-maintenance. Right, you have these basic issues of I need to eat, and I need to somehow not be killed by the hordes tomorrow. Right, those first two developmental epochs. Right, the nutrition epoch and the security age. But if I start to get into the material comfort era, okay, now there's some self-gratification coming into play. Right, and is self-gratification innately bad? No. Right? Every world goes through the material comfort era. It has its place. It's not, the goal. But it's important for you to get into that material comfort era so that you can begin to get the inevitabilities set up. Right? Those contrasts of the inevitabilities. They don't really begin to manifest until you get to the material comfort era. Right? And you get those stark contrasts so that now altruism is possible, for instance. Okay? But all good things taken to extreme become bad. Right? And self-gratification is a biggie. And that's as a stress, in spades in these papers, that ever more intense fascination with your navel, is causing an imploding of civilization, where it's just all about you and your supposed needs, and you call them rights. I have a right to this, that, and the other thing, right? Me. It's getting very, very excessive. Not a lot of subordination like they were talking about. And again, that's the reason that we've suddenly kind of gotten so uppity like this is because 2,000 years ago, a spiritual uplifter came and juiced us up a little bit. And it took a while to kind of get the pump primed, but it's definitely, especially by the middle of the 20th century, it was getting going, And so, right, you now have the potential to imagine yourself apart from the material mindal collective. It's like, no, I stand spiritually apart. And see, and technically, you do. And therein lies, you see, a new problem. Now that you have more potential to imagine yourself being able to stand on your own and not need the group, you have to take hold of the reins all the more and control yourself. Right? So that you stay in the group. Don't run with that that imagination that seems to be telling you that you've got what it takes already innately in you. You could really get delusional in that way if you get some inkling way ahead of its time of your adjuster. That'll really make you think that I don't need anyone else. Wow. Matter of fact, I think I might even be God. So what do I need anyone else for? See, that could really get you off on that tangent. Because, how self-satisfying is an experience that you have a fragment of infinity inside of you? Will you find infinity inadequate? Or will you find it quite complete?
Right. You'll find it.
All right.
You'll find your fellows inadequate.
Yeah. So the moment that you start to get some spiritual things in play, it can get very, very dicey.
Remember to be humble.
The humility thing is going to be very, very needed. All right, so anyway, you can certainly start to take greater and greater delight in yourself when you literally have the time luxury for this whole self-gratification pursuit. When you have the option of fancy food instead of crappy food, right? That the option for most of human history was never in play, right? And so gluttony just wasn't there, right? You just didn't want to eat a lot of that crap. You wanted to eat enough so that you didn't, pass out, in the middle of the battle, wielding your broadsword. But, why are we all getting overweight? Because it's the material comfort era. All good things taken to extreme become bad.
No, Chris, it's a conspiracy.
I'm certainly not at fault. Greed, drunkenness, tyranny.
Right.
Like we talked about, and remember, that's the whole, that's where it really starts to get difficult for the prince's staff if they're not well led. It's like, no, my job is to get them into gluttony and tyranny and greed? That's my job? Yeah, that's your job. Very patiently move them one developmental epoch after another, right? It's like, no, I envision moving him into light and life. Can't we just do that now? No, we do that then, not now. Now you move them into greed and gluttony and tyranny and drunkenness.
They've got to get their fill.
Right.
Talk about the next.
That's the appropriate step. Every world goes through that. Because it's an indispensable step. There's no way to get to the quest for knowledge and wisdom except through the excesses of the material comfort era. It's in the excesses that you wake up, right? All of the tribulation that those excesses lead to produce the wisdom, right? You can't get wisdom through anything except tribulation. So if there's nothing that generates tribulation, you never get wisdom.
So how do we keep people moving through these instead of just stalling out when they get there?
Right, yeah. I mean, one way is if they have the imaginative ability to see something beyond that, but it can be very difficult if people aren't very imaginative. It's hard for them. If they have an option between an encouragement to take hold of something that you can't touch, that you can only visualize abstractly, and something that they can hold, right? They're going to pick something they can hold.
Until it hurts.
Yeah.
Well, can we make the thing that's real abstract really shiny and sparkly?
Yeah, again, you're looking for those that have that capacity.
Right.
Yeah. And don't worry about it. The evolutionary process is working with those that don't have that capacity right now. Especially when you're talking about the fifth epical revelation. I mean, you're looking for someone who can relate to something this abstract. Right? It's obviously not a dispensational revelation. It's hard to find anyone. Right? You can go to our best, Ivy League institutions or something like that, and it's hard to find anyone anymore that can think that abstractly. Right? We're all just imploding into this very immediate gratification, tangible sort of existence.
Well,
All right, let's see. Let's get maybe a couple more paragraphs in here.
Society is concerned with self-perpetuation, self-maintenance, and self-gratification. But human self-realization is worthy of becoming the immediate goal of many cultural groups.
Okay, so those are the three that we hit on all the time. They added in the self-perpetuation there. But think about, again, relative to those developmental epics, right? You've got nutrition epic, security age, material comfort era. Just think about how that's all about various manifestations of self-perpetuation, self-maintenance, and self-gratification, right? Like we were just talking about. But to go beyond that, see, but human, right, just really start bringing in something that's more unnatural, and hence human, of self-realization, not merely self-actualization, but self-realization. The quest for knowledge and wisdom. And beyond that, the epic of philosophy and brotherhood. Remember, those are together because brotherhood is predicated on kindred minds, not merely the potential of kindred spirits. Right? Kindred minds don't come from science and religion. That's a philosophic fact. Right, so that whole bit of self-realization, getting a personal living philosophy in the upper domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind, if you're going to be, if for there to be a socialized philosophic society, a genuine civilization, right, there has to be in the individuals first. Right? You can't socialize that which you don't possess. Right? You need to develop a relationship to truth, and then have a mastered self that can, through which that truth can manifest outward to the world, and it produce a socialized phenomenon. All right, let's just do this one last paragraph here, because it'll kind of prepare us for next time here. Good place to stop.
The herd instinct in natural man is hardly sufficient to account for the development of such a social organization as now exists on Urantia. Though this innate gregarious propensity lies at the bottom of human society, much of man's sociability is an acquirement. Two great influences which contributed to the early association of human beings were food hunger and sex love. These instinctive urges man shares with the animal world. Two other emotions which drove human beings together and held them together were vanity and fear, more particularly ghost fear.
Remember that, the supposed perils of eternity that they mentioned before? All right, so we'll get into a lot about that ghost fear and things. This serves as a preface for next time, but also I just wanted to read it because we talked about that. Notice they bring it in the first half of that paragraph. And they purposely said lies at the bottom of human society, right? What is that, as I mentioned right up front, what is that foundation upon which mere society is predicated, right? What they say at the beginning there. What is that herd instinct, that innate gregarious propensity? That's the fifth adjutant, right? All right, so just like I was saying before, that's the... the fifth adjutant is that social urge, is that energy gets this going. That's it. That lies at the bottom of all this. But recognizing that we have something beyond that, in many ways, what the revelation is here to do is to try to get us to go back to the foundation of civilization that we're losing here, that is really a socialization of a human quality that we're given by grace with that initial encirclement in the Holy Spirit, and begin to take delight in cultivating, building, being grown from that starting point. And we do need to go back. There's a reason why this book was given to us way back then, because that's where the real beginning lies. It's, you can't start with what we have now. We've almost lost everything now. You need to go back to the beginning of the 20th century and get that civilizational structure again back in play, and then build from there. And as you can see, they're going to start to deal with this whole issue of, as they italicize there, not just what gets it going, but what holds it together. Yeah, because you have, you have this whole maintenance issue of, when you're still pretty primitive, what keeps you engaged to do what's so unnatural? There has to initially that, we're not very self-motivating. We have to be cattle prodded a lot, and by some very, primitive things, you might say, very self-centered things, like vanity.
Right?
To see the, and to not think in dichotomies about stuff like vanity. That's when they're going to start getting into that. To see vanity in an evolutionary context. To see how it's part of perfectingness, even though obviously it's not a part of perfectness. Right? And to not think existentially like that, dichotomously about it like that, right? That it's just innately bad. Right? It's in an evolutionary context, it serves a very important purpose. We of course, as we go through these civilizations, we're going to get into those initial indispensables, right, to the progress of early civilization: slavery, war, social classes, and profit motive, which anyone with any idealistic consciousness sees problems with, right? And might want to just dismiss them, baby bathwater and all. All right, so all those sorts of things, that's what they're transitioning into now. They've kind of given you the foundations, and now they want to start to get you to think in more sophisticated terms about the role that things that appear to be valueless play. They aren't really valueless. They appear to be valueless because you're predicated too much on a single parent, your existential father. You need to bring in a little bit more of your other parent, your experiential mother, to begin to see these things in their true light, and not be so quick, like Katie was saying a while back, to just throw it all out, because on the surface it appears to be nothing but bad. War, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. No, if it was good for absolutely nothing, it wouldn't exist. Right. Okay, so that's where we'll pick up next time. I'll have to try to remember. It's always difficult when we stop in the middle of a section like this and remind myself where we are. But
it's a big paragraph.
Yeah, but it is a big paragraph break. You see there's a big paragraph break there. That's why I went for that one.
We ended at Fear of the Boogeyman. Yeah. Back to the war, was it good for absolutely nothing? Yeah. Until I read the Revelation, that's exactly how I perceived it.
Yeah.
I think it's the way most people perceive it.
Yeah.
Maybe because of the mother concept of the fact that you were killing, war kills each other.
Yeah.
Kills our brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
We
all know we'll spend a whole bunch of time talking about war when we get to that here in these papers. So I just wanted to toss that out, tease about that's, start thinking about that. That's what we're going to be challenging ourselves to do is, they'll hit us with some, hopelessly controversial things right away as we start reading about men and women and stuff. So, all right. Anyway, let's take a moment here, everyone.